in terms of carbon sequestration, that this sort of composition for our climate, maybe a 20% cover of trees and 80% of grass, has an extremely high potential for sequestration, just in terms of like photosynthetic surface. Like, how much sun can you capture? I like to think that we're in the business of actually photosynthesizing. Like, photosynthesis is our main yield. Can't get paid for it, so we turn that into beef and eggs and pork and things like that.
Welcome to Tangled Taproot, where we explore the unique stories of small-scale farmers here in the Midwest. I'm Jackson.
I'm John.
I'm Kristen.
And this is a production of Milk and Hummus.
What is milk and hummus?
I'm going to tell you. We make flavorful hummus and a ready-to-drink plant-based latte that focuses on locally sourced ingredients, sustainable packaging, and the humble chickpea. In this episode, we talk with Ben Brownlow of Fox Holler Farmstead.
What a interview. What a farmstead.
I mean, the size alone, the scale is insane. He said it's 280 acres.
Yeah.
This fellow spoke with so much authority as far as like his experience and what he's learned and scientifically, but also in just such depth. I don't know. I was just personally in shock and awe with the sort of detail of what he knows about the land and sort of the intimacy he has with the ecology of the acres that he stewards.
Well, it seemed what was super cool. Yeah, it seemed like everything that he did, like it was like a solution to a problem that he had. He was like, oh, my cows, maybe it didn't happen exactly like this, but oh, my cows could be happier. They'd be happier if they had these trees that they could have shade under. And then they just so happened to have, because they had the trees, they had all of these, the chestnuts that fell down. And so at the end of the season, there's all these chestnuts and he's, oh, well, I guess I need pigs to come in and clean up so that way we don't have like pests. So it was just like this like working process of him just like doing it all, and one thing was like another solution to another thing, and it really just worked out.
Before we continue, go on Instagram, look up Fox Holler Farmstead, and just so you can see these little critters, these heritage breed pigs and poultry, and they're just,
are they stinking cute?
Yeah, they're super gorgeous, and they're just in their
Yeah, you will have never seen heritage turkeys before, probably, and they're just distinctly different than what you envision as an overfat-fed factory-farmed turkey, and they're just out foraging. Yeah, take a look at these photos. It's beautiful, and you'll probably be inspired.
Just hearing all of the things, like listening to the interview and hearing all of the things that they do, he's, oh yeah, we do. We've got animals and plants, so we also do the preservation, like all this, everything. I was just like, what? This is insane. To me, it sounded like the thing that we all talk about, right? Getting together with a group of your friends and being like, hey, let's just buy this plot of land and we're going to be like self-contained. And he did it.
Yeah.
He said 280 acres, 40 of that is like for humans to habitate. He's out there doing like the thing that we all like secretly are wishing to do.
Yeah, he made some dreams come true. And I was really impressed with this sort of bluntness and confidence that he was explaining this as, no, I'd prefer to not talk about it in a highfalutin, regenerative manner. I would reference this as agroecology. And I was like, ooh, this guy has some terms.
Yes, indeed.
That's a great way to think about it, because it really is such a circular cycle, the land, the management, and just how interconnected certain species are. And like you mentioned, the pest control, what can manage the pests, benefits from shade, cows are happier, these eat that, pigs forage this. Or the rooting up of invasive trees that were sprouting up through the pasture.
Right.
You know, he learned that goats, where the pigs would get those pulled up or at least loosened up enough where they could come through and get those nasty invasive starts out.
Right, exactly.
Just all the interconnectedness was like just really interesting to listen to.
He writes these field notes and he shares them. He self-publishes. He's basically not only like a poet or of the land that he's stewarding, but also from a scientific fundamental planning standpoint, he's able to look back on his notes and say, oh, this worked, this didn't, And he's planning, I think, like 10 years out right now with chestnut trees.
Through that documentation, through the Fox Holler Almanac that he has published online, it allows him to have a forecast of what to expect or anticipate, right? As the next year comes around, this is what was happening in June. This is what was happening early July or whatever. It just seems like he's putting forth a lot of effort to document and really get to know the land, right? So you can anticipate needs or how he solved a problem or to become a better manager and steward of all of these acres. I don't know how you'd even get started. Just an acre.
Yeah, 1 acre.
And that's so much more. And just the different terrain. I think you described forests, grasslands.
Yeah, he had mentioned like there's certain crops, certain tree crops that just don't want to grow in certain places. And so you just have to figure out, become one with the land and figure out what's going to go, what's going to do better where.
And how to best keep it natural.
Which he seems to be doing a good job. Yeah.
And I think there are 2 different grow zones on the land. I'm not certain of that, but he had some challenges with the different climate.
For sure.
Microclimates. Yeah. Yeah. I know we've already talked about this extensively, but I really thought that was an interesting metaphor, how he said that managing this expanse of land and all of the natural relationships therein was like a complex game of chess. Because one move affects the other
100%.
And affects the next thing you do and trickle-down effect.
Yeah, and I think that was the most impressive thing to me about this land, because it is such a huge plot of land, and being able to manage it in the way that he's doing, one thing is affecting the other, and like you've got this one problem, and then it's okay, well, let's bring these in, because they, one problem solves the other. It's just, I don't know, it's really cool. Or one solution, yeah, it's really cool.
The easy road to just be coming in with a chemical spray and just get rid of this stuff. But then what is the cost of that? That is almost always a negative impact to an ecosystem when you're bringing in a foreign chemical.
Absolutely.
Let alone foreign species. Fox Holler, they're doing things as natural as they can possibly can and coming up with these integrative strategies to handle those problems and face them. And that's what this interview is about. And it's really exciting to listen to. Everybody's going to learn something. The tree crop stuff was fascinating. The idea of, I hadn't really thought about it, but how you can glean perennial things off of trees. So it's not just when they're fruiting, but then also you talked about this mulberry leaf.
Oh my gosh. Crazy
high protein.
I want to make
from
mulberry
tree.
Yeah, mulberry leaf tofu. He was saying I want to make.
Yeah, so somewhere in Korea where they make mulberry leaf tofu.
I like took a note of that because I was like, I need to find this.
It blew me away because I've heard of hazelnuts. I've heard of oak trees, acorns, chestnuts, hickory nuts, bitter nuts. And we've all heard of like mulberries, but I just picture some cute little red berry. But he specifically spoke to the power, strength, and protein of the mulberry leaf that has been specifically bred to be increased in protein for 10,000 years. To increase the fiber spinning strength of silkworms, because that's what they're fed.
That's right.
So it's just all because of the silk culture through the millennia and this that apparently the silkworms enjoy eating mulberry leaves. And now it's this super high protein thing. And he's talking about that. And that's just an incredible piece of insight that seemed very hyper specific and just out of our league.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Yeah, no, I thought that was pretty impressive too. I made sure to make a note of mulberry leaves so that I could try to acquire some.
I love mulberries in general. And a lot of people view them as not necessarily invasive, but like a weed nuisance tree of sorts. But yeah.
And then we look at this positive perspective on something else we can get from a mulberry that is not widely known.
Yeah.
That's why I love this podcast. I'm always taking something away. People will have pecans, right? Missouri's kind of known for pecan trees, or even Central and South Illinois kind of has a nice breadth and depth of pecan harvesting.
Right.
But he really spoke about, some sort of rare and exclusive nuts that are like chestnuts and hazelnuts and that type of thing.
Less common, for sure. Yeah.
Rare breed nuts. You definitely had some scientific insight on that, John, with
you seemed really excited about this interview.
Yeah, your biological depths and education shined through on the talks.
Oh, good. Good to hear. Fox Hollow really does have a diverse flora and fauna.
Yeah, several animals. They've got a lot of space for animals. This farmstead specifically has, I think we've heard, 6 cows. They're adding another cow this spring, a large herd of pigs, all heirloom varieties or heritage breeds, a goat flock. I made that up. It's probably a herd of goats, but they raise quite a few turkeys. Again, a heritage breed varieties, chickens, and then this wide array of tree crops, too.
Yeah, they do it all.
Yeah, let's get into it. Let's get into it, Ben. Looking forward.
I'm Ben Brownlow. I've been doing this Fox Holler Farmstead thing, maybe you might say a dozen years or so at this point.
It's a good track record.
It's a good track record. I have not made enough money to move into a different line of work.
It seems like you're still pretty vested in it and probably, I would assume, learned a lot in those 12 years. I think you mentioned this is called a project rather than a farm. What do you mean by that?
Just in terms of our marketing and trying to break things down as simply as possible when we're working with the public. Yeah, Fox Holler Farmstead is the name of our project. And to me, it's an umbrella. So we do pastured pork and pastured poultry, heirloom vegetables, but we also, there's a lot of cooperation involved in the project. So we've been developing an agroforestry cooperative over the last 2 years. And so that kind of cycles into our work a little bit. And then we have some kind of cross-pollination with neighboring sub-community, dandelion. And we also, some years back, discovered that doing the work of all of our own dairying work was just too much for us. So we broke our dairying into a cooperative as well. So we have a dairy cooperative. We have an agroforestry cooperative. We work with neighboring farm and then we do our own thing in the context of a larger land management goal. So our land is held in a trust. It's a community land trust, a legal structure. And so as a part of, so agriculture is a piece of that pie because we have a mission to try to feed our community and develop some economic resilience off of the land that we have access to. But then over 100 of those acres we're managing for native ecology and wildlife specifically.
As a preservation okay.
type piece. Working with native tallgrass, warm season prairies is a big part of our work as well.
So the native conservation end, it's not a forest, it's prairie land.
It's prairie, yeah.
Awesome, okay. What would you say the goal is for that aspect of the project?
Yeah, so it has interplay with our grazing. For example, we're looking at the 100 acres or so that are in prairie. A lot of it we leave alone entirely. I shouldn't say we leave alone. We don't manage it with livestock. We manage it with fire is a big piece of what we do. So we burn acreage.
How large is this land in total that you're working or conserving? And
we exist on a 280-acre land trust.
Wow. Okay.
About 40 of those acres are set aside for human habitation. So that's the community piece of the community land trust. What will eventually one day be hopefully a dense community of people.
40 acres is quite a bit.
Right. You can fit a lot of humans in 40 acres, right? And compared to a standard homesteading or rural agriculture model where you've got a house that has 80 acres to itself, 80 acres of corn or soy or whatever.
Sure.
Pasture, which is more common up in Northeast Missouri where we're at, and having that spread out. We're condensing the human impact to the front of the land up along the road frontage. And then everything that's back in there is either managed as woodland, managed as prairie, or managed as agricultural land.
Okay. That's pretty ornate. Specifically the prairie land, or which subject would you want to approach first? You said dairy, you said poultry, you said there's other livestock. I saw heritage pork.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's quite a bit.
I think maybe I could succinctly pick this apart.
Yeah.
Think about it as, okay, so like food labels, right? We're familiar with organic, regenerative.
Well, regenerative is more nuanced nowadays.
Which, becoming more nuanced.
Yeah, but it's exciting, for
sure. It's exciting, and it's difficult to define. I don't choose to use that term yet because what we have is baseline data for our soils, but we don't know. We're hoping that will inform what types of management decisions we make in the future. But for me to say it's regenerative is, well, we employ potentially regenerative practices. if I had to put a label on what we do, it would be agroecology. So the idea that we have ecosystems and we have a need for agriculture to feed people, and trying to keep these things to try to match the needs instead of having them be competing. Oftentimes I see agriculture very much as it's a competition between humans and nature, and we're trying to flip that on its edge. So if we look at the way that the sort of ecosystems in Northeast Missouri may run, of course, a lot of the natural history has been erased. But what we can basically assume is that you've got wooded areas that would be along waterways. And then as you go up the slopes, things break into what you would call prairie savanna. You got some brush, then you got some open land, and then you might have trees every 80 to 100 feet. And by the way, in terms of carbon sequestration, that this sort of composition for our climate, maybe a 20% cover of trees and 80% of grass, has an extremely high potential for sequestration just in terms of photosynthetic surface. Like, how much sun can you capture? I like to think that we're in the business of actually photosynthesizing. Like, photosynthesis is like our main yield. Can't get paid for it, so we turn that into beef and eggs and pork and things like that. And then as you widen out into the hilltops and stuff, these are areas that would have been more affected by fire pre-European settlement. And so we've brought fire back into the ecology by burning these areas every 2, 3, 5 years, depending on what our management goals for a particular field are. If you look at these open areas and savanna areas, those are good for ruminant livestock. So we raise cattle. We have a couple of dairy cows. There's a cooperative formed around them so that people in our community can gain access to milk. They can put in a little bit of money. They can put in a little bit of labor. We want to see agriculture and food access be inclusive. So if somebody's better able to pay, they can pay. If someone's better able to work, they can work. And that's how we can provide for...
So there's balance still from an economic sense.
Right.
Versus economic versus labor. Okay.
Pigs are forest dwellers. So I run hogs on the woodland edge. We want to be really careful with them because pigs can also be extremely destructive animals. So they have to be moved really quickly. So all this grazing is managed in a rotational manner. It's like a chess game or like a strategy video game kind of, but with cows.
How many heads of cow would you say are currently in operation?
Yeah, I won't break down that animal units per acre, but we have currently 5 cows. We'll have 6 come April. So we have 2 mamas that we milk, and then we have a neighbor who maintains bull genetics. So he comes by and artificially inseminates our cows every year, and we get a couple of beef cows at a time. We raise those beef cows on full grass, no grain, for 2 years. And so we have between 4 and 6 cows at any given time, and 2 to 4 of them are for beef and 2 of them are for dairy. And then we keep a dozen goats, because one of the issues with prairie management in particular is woody stuff coming in, especially woody invasives. Autumn olive is a big problem for us up at, and multiflora rose. The dairy goats kind of support that. And we keep 6 to 8 nannies that we milk. Usually each one will have between 2, and we actually had 4 kids. It's kidding season right now, so we got a lot of little baby goats jumping around, which is super cute.
Yes.
We'll take and sell a lot of the promising nanny goats and get them out to people that want to milk goats, and we'll butcher a handful of weather goats for meat, and they help. There's our commando unit for cutting down on invasives.
I heard the pigs as well. Besides the goats, pigs also are prolific consumers of woody.
Absolutely, yeah. Okay. Yeah, well, if we're trying to take out something like Lespedeza or something that's a real threat to prairie ecosystems, we can get out into those Lespedeza patches a couple weeks early and we'll sprout some grains on top of the Lespedeza. You wait before a really good rain and get some oats or some corn or something out there. Let it just take root and get nice and lush. Then run those pigs out there and they'll rip up the ground trying to get to that grain that's been rooting down in there, and they'll pull up the Lespedeza while they're at it. And then when we move them to the next paddock, we can come by, check on that patch and pull at some of the roots with hand tools. We try to reduce our fossil fuel inputs on the project as well. And animals are a great way for us to get that way. I'd love to get some draft oxen at some point in my life to begin pulling our chicken wagons around. We pull the chicken wagons with tractors and trucks at this point, but would really love to take that down to the low-tech level.
It may appear low-tech, but in reality, you're harnessing one organism or several organism species, whether it be goats or pigs, to essentially remove an invasive species or try to get a certain outcome. So you're really having to know about all these different relationships. And for such a large area of land, that's pretty wild.
System complexity. On the surface, it's very simple. The opposite end of it, right, would be like precision ag.
Oh,
driverless tractors and drones.
Maybe little machines that swarm out and use electricity to zap little sprouts of weeds. But
yeah, we're not there yet.
right. No. But that's still nonetheless very exciting. So you have this whole mapped out landscape broken down between forest, between prairie. You have your animals that you run. You're also, as I understand it, interested in trees, fruiting trees. What would you call it?
Tree crops. Yeah. And it's becoming the direction I'm pretty interested in transitioning towards, particularly in some of these, looking back at the sort of ecological focus of the project. There are areas that don't want to be prairie. They very much want to come up in trees. And so we can, but the trees that they want to come up in are often these invasive species. Those areas don't burn as well. It'll be something like the aspect of the slope holds more humidity, so you never get the high humidity that you need to get a real hot burn. So it's woody things want to grow there. The gambit is, well, can we manipulate it to be woody trees that we can get along with and that provide value to human beings and that also aren't intrusive upon the landscape or even match what might have originally been here? The focus this year is going to be on Chinese chestnut. While a substitute for American chestnut, which wouldn't have actually been this far west on the landscape, most likely historically, is parallel with oak or hickory. And we've done some work with oak and hickory as well. We have hazels and hickories because they have a lot of potential value in the future if we have food infrastructure that starts to reflect a perennialized food system versus an annual food system. Like the oil in hazelnuts or hickories per acre is a higher yield than olives, and it requires less inputs than soybean oil. We just need the processing infrastructure. That's where,
oh, wow. Interesting.
That's where some of these projects that we have are really looking towards a potential future. What if there was the potential to...
So to be
processing
oil?
Hickory oil, yeah.
I've never, you go down the grocery store today, you won't find that.
That's a niche product, yeah.
Would that be for like a cooking oil, like a high SEF or a high oleic type oil?
Yes, it would.
Okay.
Yes, it would, yeah.
A higher smoke point.
The oiliest native hickory we have here is, folks call it bitternut hickory.
Interesting.
Now, it is, as a nut, very bitter to eat, but the oil pressing and extraction tends to leave those tannins in the mash, and the oil has a sort of a clean flavor to it, or at least it's not a bitter flavor. It's got a nuttiness to it, obviously.
Well, I mean, people eating olives, those olives, I don't even think are, like, a person wouldn't enjoy necessarily the olives for olive oil.
Right, they're extremely tannic, right? Yeah.
So, yeah, it's not like your table olive or something. So that's really interesting. I have never heard of that. That's cool. Okay.
So Chinese chestnuts is becoming a focus for us just because the infrastructure and economics are already there. It's a much in-demand nut. It's the most important nut in the United States. There are purchasing co-ops in the Midwest, at least one, where we can take it like a commodity crop, which I do enjoy marketing because I love meeting people, but I don't actually like... If I could just sell all of my food in one day and then be done with it, that'd be pretty sweet too.
Oh, sure. That's also, isn't that a CSA model, like where you get all your funds up front or just say, hey, but I guess you wouldn't know the poundage and results. So you're saying Chinese chestnuts, that is going to be a crop that you would like to bring to market.
It is.
In the near future.
And so one of the other things that I enjoy doing and that I think we do pretty well is our heritage breed turkey program. And so we do rotationally pastured heritage breed turkeys, and I already fatten them up on acorns right now, pin oak acorns. I get them under the pin oaks starting around September all until Thanksgiving time or thereabouts, and we can really fatten them up on acorns. I usually hit those areas with the pigs first, and they'll take a big share of the acorns, and then the turkeys will pick through and they'll find the ones that the pigs didn't. I've learned a lesson, which is to leave some acorns because, well, It's the main food source for blue jays and squirrels and things. And if those animals don't find the acorns, then they'll come and they'll take the spawn out of our mushroom logs, or they'll strip the bark off of trees because they're hungry. So it's one thing to say, oh, I'm interested in agriculture that takes into account ecology. And then when you realize how complex ecology is and how our decisions come back on us.
It's a complicated, you go back to your science class when you're young, you know, food webs, like how do they interact? But this can be pretty complicated when you're bringing in all sorts of different species and targeting one species for survival versus another. Just real quick, back to the chestnuts, those price per pound are pretty high. Is that because they're more difficult to grow, or again, niche, or maybe the equipment to harvest is different?
Yeah, the harvesting equipment, there's not a lot of it present in the United States. There's like a three-year waiting list to get the Italian like harvest tractors, the implements that come in. It's like a big vacuum cleaner.
Oh, wow.
You come in with.
It's not a tree shaker.
It's not a tree shaker. The chestnuts will drop on the ground, and then you got to get them before the deer do. What right now with chestnuts is walk out and pick them up.
Sure. Labor intensive.
Yeah, labor intensive. And so in terms of, and so I do feel like when it comes time for us to start doing labor on 5 acres of chestnuts, it's going to be considerable labor, and I'm hoping that we can work into our final economics being able to pay people a fair wage for picking those things up. So there is a bit of a longer-term economic development piece.
And then at the end of the day, too, let's say the consumer, the person that's purchasing the chestnuts, since it's not like your walnut, your pecan, hazelnut, what?
Right.
Maybe there might be some education involved in terms of how do I eat this, or what do I put it in, or
right. Yeah, they're different than other nuts in a lot of ways. They're starchy, they're not particularly oily. They're nutritionally, pound for pound, I've heard people say it's the same as brown rice, or it's similar to grain corn. So it's more of a carb crop, which is interesting.
Yeah.
And typically they have to be cooked to be prepared. You've heard of roasted chestnuts. You can also steam them. Yeah, and so there's a little bit of education that comes for them. But then there's a certain subset of folks out there, a lot of folks that have immigrated to the United States that remember chestnuts from wherever they grew up and know exactly what to do with them. And that seems to be a big base for the chestnut market right now. But yeah, more education out there would be useful.
Sure. No, that's exciting. And growing up, I was able to have my parents show me how to roast chestnuts, and I got to enjoy them. And yeah, they're pretty awesome and specialty, at least for right now. It seems after, would you have your animals go through there afterwards or at all? Or are you, would you say those are just for humans or?
Yeah. So silvopasture or alley cropping with animals. So is the idea that we have to provide tree shade for our livestock to improve their welfare and standard their existence. People think of cows as they're beasts of the grass, but they really like to sit down underneath a tree and ruminate and get that dappled sun on them, the dappled shade on them. It does a lot better for their performance. You might be losing grass per acre. You might, from a real dry agronomic standpoint, you might be saying, oh, the pounds of forage per acre, you're losing so much by having shade on the pasture, but the cows form better. The healthier they are, the more access to shade, especially in a world that's just getting hotter.
Right.
Like, yeah. Giving cows shade is one of the best things you can do for them, not only just from a humane standpoint, but also economically. Like, they need somewhere cool to digest their food. If they're constantly hot, like, they're not going to be gaining as much weight as you want.
You want them to be less stressed.
Less stress, yeah. Absolutely. So if one...
You know, it's a lot less stress.
If tree crops can do one thing, it's provide less stress for animals and heat. And they also can provide shelter, you know, in cold winds and stuff like that. Another layer is that these trees can provide, so they can provide nutrition. We're looking at our chestnut crop is primarily for humans, and it's also a breeding crop that we're working with the Chestnut Improvement Network through Mizzou. This is a breeding plot of chestnuts. So they're going to be looking at what's coming off of our trees and comparing our genetic material to theirs and trying to come up with better varieties for the Midwest based off of the
success rate.
The success rate on these things. And they have a whole host of things they're looking at. But trees also, so like persimmons, the native persimmons, we love them. Our chickens also love them. So our winter chicken area is filled with, we planted a bunch of persimmon trees. We planted honey locusts for the pigs and the goats because they'll eat those pods. The chestnuts that, you know, because we're organic, if you leave chestnuts on the ground, the chestnut weevils and stuff will take hold in them, and then you've got pest issues. So by cleaning up the landscape after post-harvest, bring the pigs out, have them eat up everything that got thrown to the side.
They do the work for you.
They do the work of that cleanup and provide a certain level of hygiene.
Sure.
Got to be very careful about putting livestock in where you're also growing human food because of fecal contamination. Doing that at the end of the season in November, having them clean things up in November and not having them back out there until the following November and giving a good 6-month period before any... Yeah.
Degrade. And
it's probably best practice. I'll just say that. But even the leaves, animals love to eat leaves, and trees drop leaves are on the ground if they don't get too funky. I love mulberry leaves are really awesome fodder for animals. Actually, people can eat the leaves too.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
They're not that great, but at certain cultures, I know in Korea, they produce a mulberry leaf-based tofu product. Really interesting stuff because it's a very high protein leaf. It was originally been bred for 10,000 years for silk production to high protein for silkworms.
Oh, okay. All right.
And so I have a lot of interest in trying to find mulberries where the leaves strip off of the shoots more easily so that you can gather handfuls of these leaves and throw them out to the pigs. Monogastric animals like pigs and chickens can actually eat mulberry leaves and digest them, whereas they don't do so well on grasses and other things because...
And that's a good source of protein for those animals then.
Absolutely.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So just kind of looking towards what the natural biological infrastructure for what can actually support agriculture in this sort of non-competitive way. And that's how I'd sum up project.
No, that's a great summary. And that's incredibly impressive. And so the goal is having this community that's supported by, so agroecology, you said.
Yeah.
Community supported by this as well as the, I guess, the native wildlife as well as the agricultural animals and just balance.
Yeah.
That's insane. Actually, that's insanely awesome. So how did you grow into this interest? Or there's obviously your first generation farmer.
Oh, yeah.
So how did this originate, this interest?
Yeah, I'm a city kid. The DIY punk scene was really big in my youth, and I came from dumpster dive culture and DIY bike repair culture and food not bombs culture and things like that. Over time, I'd say I developed a relationship with material things and understanding. My relationship with material things has shifted over time where I've begun to ask questions about...
Why do things I buy break? Why can't I repair certain things? What is it called? Like when something's intended to break...
Right. Planned obsolescence.
Yeah. And just the inefficiencies and waste of society.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, inefficiency and waste played a role in my shift towards agriculture. I raise a lot of animal products now, but I was also really a big part of DIY vegan stuff, too, when I was younger. And I still firmly support a largely plant-based diet.
Sure.
For most people.
Yeah.
In our climate and under my circumstances, I choose to use animals as a repair tool and a repair mechanism for this larger ecosystem work that we're doing that we could do 2 hours on that, but we won't. What I'll say is that I think I developed an interest in ecology before I developed an interest in agriculture. And I think after a while, I came to see agriculture as this big question. Well, how do we feed people and maintain native ecology in different places? And I also think that trying to build more resilience and reliance within communities rather than reliance upon larger systems of industrialization and control became part. So it's because I'm a punk kid.
Sure,
How I ended up doing this.
So escaping monoculture, really seeing symbiotic relationship between agriculture, society, and the natural native habitats.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's fun. There's cool tools. You get to go for nice walks. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah,
a lot of that. Work with your hands.
Yeah.
All right. And then I guess the next question would be like, how did you obtain the information? Was it, you said DIY, did you use YouTube, internet, books, seminars?
A lot of that stuff. I did start off doing some woofing. I wouldn't say that I learned a lot during my woofing experiences.
Sure. And for those that don't know, what is woofing?
Willing Workers on Organic Farms is what the acronym stood for when I was in it. And I think they might have changed what it actually stands for now, or maybe that's what it still is. But it's basically a program you can apply to where you can volunteer to do work in different farms, and they'll choose to host you, and they may or may not be completely forthright about the arrangements.
Sure. Unfortunately, yeah.
Yeah. I picked up a few things there. I just, through acquaintances, have had the opportunity to hang out on other people's homesteads, off-grid homesteads, and gain some skills there. I do enjoy reading. I do a lot of reading. And then coming to Northeast Missouri and becoming part of the larger land trust, I had the opportunity to meet a lot of folks who have taught me a lot of things. We're 3 miles away from Sandhill Farms, which used to be a pretty large-scale organic sorghum producer. They've since kind of shut down their sorghum syrup stuff, but there's a lot of rooted knowledge in the community. I'm also, Northeast Missouri is home to a lot of Mennonite and Amish folks. And so I do like to learn in person, and I'm a big book nerd. So books like J. Russell Smith's Tree Crops have been influential to me as well.
Okay. Okay. And then why would you say you decided to live or operate in Northeast Missouri?
Obviously, I'm in St. Louis today, and it's really fun to get to connect with a more diverse community, and it's really fun to bring what we have here and be able to take in what y'all have, and there's a mutual enrichment thing that goes on, but I liked the very low population. We have no stoplights
in Scotland County,
which is, it's pretty far and away. So I like the tucked in nature, and we don't have a very active county government. So things like building codes, you could build a straw bale house just fine and don't have a lot of people coming down on you for experimental building.
That is actually pretty awesome. Is I've always thought it'd be really cool. Oh, just if you know how to or learn how to do something, you want to try it out. And well, you don't have to go spend like whatever the cost for a permit.
Yeah.
On something.
And when I was looking at earlier, 13 years ago, when I was looking at the climate projection models that they had available at the time, I was looking that there was a line north of Northeast Missouri where the prediction was that things would be cooler and wetter and that it'd be hotter and drier south of it. So I thought I put myself right on the line. That would be perfect. What it actually means is we get drought and flood in the same year sometimes.
All right. So some challenges for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then in general, you're focused on a lot of minimizing your reliance on fossil fuels, and you're using rainwater. You're using a lot more solar. All that requires a lot of knowledge, I would imagine. Again, this is something you're tapping into your community for understanding as well, or?
There's a lot of knowledge to be gained from folks that I've met. My dad is always just a kind of fix-it dude, too. I keep my systems pretty simple, maybe to a fault. All of the electricity that I run off of is 12 volts, so
okay. There's
only two wires, and you can usually figure out where they belong.
Nice.
Trial and error, sometimes just like really needing to rely on something will give a person the motivation to learn it.
And then also, from what I've read, you're a really avid writer.
Yeah.
Tell me about how that plays into your life.
Yeah. I spent a lot of time walking back and forth with buckets across the prairie, buckets full of feed, buckets full of eggs. Sometimes I spent a lot of time hoeing up spots in the garden, or we use like scythes for cutting the grass and mowing out our paddocks for portable fence. So I don't know. I just have
A lot of things on my mind.
At some point, I thought I should just start writing these down. I've always enjoyed writing.
But it's not just like editorial. It's very poetic and very, good.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Yeah.
So would you call it blog type, or there's a number of different formats?
It can come to your inbox in a newsletter. So what I write is what I've been trying to write, but I'm really good at getting off subject. That's one of my strengths. My main writing project right now is called the Fox Holler Almanac, and it's like an almanac, right? You think about the old Farmer's Almanac and those things that come out where every week something's going on. out on the land. This week, it's worms. There's just worms all over the place. It's just, it's worm time. Maybe it's got something to do with the phase of the moon or the moisture in the soil. I don't know, but there's worms everywhere. So I might start writing about, oh, it looks like it's worm season. And I could take that and go with it from there. So I loosely format my writing as an almanac. So it's seasonal, right? Just like onions are seasonal or eggs are seasonal more than people think. And then I like to just branch off from there and go in any direction. I also really enjoy writing about the history of agrarian labor movements.
Okay. But that's also very naturalistic and, or being a naturalist, it's, let's see here, you're able to revisit what you've written in the future for data, for looking at when to maybe what areas of your land are more fertile. Or...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I could look back on these things and say, oh, hey, it looks like I can expect that these few natural events to be occurring around this time. After a while, you start realizing when things flower and you start making correlations. And I love all that old folk wisdom that's like usually half not true, where there's, oh, yeah, the morels will be out by the time the oak leaves are the size of a squirrel's ear. I love that stuff. I don't know if there's any correlation, but I like drawing connections and creating correlations and just listening to what the land has to tell me. I think like such a big part of farming in nature has to do with observation. And like most of the day, I hopefully am shutting up and paying attention. And then the couple hours a week that I sit down to write, then it's my turn.
Yeah. No, that's amazing and something to definitely look back on and share with a lot of people, which is pretty cool, especially those that are living in the city, don't have desire and escape and desire understanding some of the, I guess, the systems at play in the northeast Missouri.
Yeah. And it's so great to come here because I also lack perspective.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. It balances everything out. For those desiring to connect with Fox Holler Farmstead, how would someone go about doing that?
Well, let's see. We got the Insta, Fox Holler Farmstead. The almanac is available at foxhollermanac.com. I just bought that URL for $12.
Nice.
But you can go there and sign up. There's a free newsletter, or you can choose to support it financially if you want. And foxholler.com is my lightly maintained business website where you could pre-order turkey or pork sides.
And then people could, in the city at least, or where could people find your products, or how would someone buy some of your heritage, either poultry or...
We've been doing everything through City Greens this past year. They've been really great, awesome to work with. So City Greens Market.
Perfect.
They usually carry our eggs. We bring eggs by about once a month and they get sold out pretty quick. And then last year we did distribution of heritage turkey and pork sides in November, and hopefully looking forward to doing that again this year because... Definitely going to be taking more turkeys and trailers down to those acorns and got to do something with them.
Sure. No, that's exciting. Anything else that you want to let folks know about? Anything on the horizon?
Yeah, we'll have chestnuts in about 15 years.
Yeah, set your calendars.
Yeah.
That's how long it takes, about 15 years to produce a fruiting, you can call it fruited nuts, or a nut.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's a lot of variability. I've heard 8 years is pretty good for things to start bearing. I think we'll be in pretty substantial production. My back of the envelope math was that we'd probably be entering the 5,000 to 10,000 pound range.
Okay. That's pretty sizable. And fortunately, you don't need to graft.
You don't need to. And there's so much debate in the world of like, I think good quality seedlings is important. Seedlings from proven trees is important. In some climates, grafting works really well and you can get a jump start by a few years. And in other climates, the grafts work great for a while. And then one day the tree says, the rootstock says no, and then just throws the...
Sure.
Yeah. I also got to put out just a plug for Asian pears. They're an awesome crop.
Do you have to graft those?
Yeah.
Apples you do in order to have something that's like a table apple or whatever that's not used for cider.
Yeah. The Asian pear rootstocks are often weird little hard fruits. Sometimes they'll be those calorie pears, those invasive pears, which I've seen so many in flower on the way down here. Bradford pears. You can graft Asian pears onto those.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So
neat. So is that a crop that you have on your land trust?
Yeah. Yeah. We've had some ups and downs with them. Yeah, Kim's Orchard over here We had a wildfire go through that last spring, and so we're still figuring out what the damage is on a lot of those pear and apple trees that were over there. But I've been planting a lot more, and that's gonna, I might have a glut of them at some point, but now it's just like mostly for our own eating and for the pigs.
Nice. Okay. Yeah, Asian pears, they taste amazing. They're very sweet.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do wish I saw them more often at the grocer.
Yeah.
Well, thanks a lot for your time and sharing. It's looking forward to watching virtually on Instagram and hearing about it through your writing. Also looking forward to tasting some of those products in the near future.
Totally. Cool. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Take care.
Thanks again to Ben Brownlow of Fox Holler Farmstead for taking the time to speak with us. You can find more information and enjoy some of the photographs and storytelling and almanac details if you go to foxholler.com or on social media, Fox Holler Farmstead. Be sure to take a read.
Absolutely. This is Tingle Taproot, a production of Milk and Hummus. I'm John.
I'm Kristen.
And I'm Jackson.
If you'd like what you've heard, please share and review us. Again, thanks so much for listening. Send us your thoughts. Don't delay. TingleTaproot@milkandhummus.com. We will answer your questions and share your feedback. Until next time.
Yes, please write in. We're waiting with bated breath.